I started reading a book recently. If you ask Gracie, I probably start reading books more than I finish reading that same book. But the introduction to this book, it's by Malcolm Gladwell. He's not a religious person, not a religious author, but a good author nonetheless. And it's called Blink. The book is called Blink, and it's about making snap judgments. And he sets it up explaining that there's several studies that have been done that demonstrate that the snap judgments that our brains make on their own are oftentimes surprisingly accurate. That, we can have a single interaction with a person and be able to surprisingly accurately discern the characteristics that they will portray in certain contexts. And we do that not because we're consciously analyzing information that we've been set, that we've had set before us, but rather our brain just picks up on little things and puts it all together for us and gives us kind of a gut feeling. And that gut feeling is oftentimes on the mark. In his introduction to the book Blink, Malcolm Gladwell tells a story about an art museum that was presented with a potentially extremely valuable statue. And it was a certain kind of Greek statue, and it had several markers of being authentic. But the extreme value and the rarity of the statue and the near perfect condition it was in kind of seemed too good to be true. But the art museum kind of wanted it to be true. It was extremely valuable. So they took it on loan, and they set their lawyers, their experts, their archaeologists all onto this project, and they worked for months and months and looked over this statue, and they traced the origin of it back to a reputable art dealer. They went through hours of studying and researching to make sure it was real, right? That it had all of the cultural markers that were associated with that kind of art from that time period. And they went through this entire process. They investigated it so thoroughly, they thought, that they were sure it was real. And they wanted it to be real. But then they unveiled it before, at different times, respectively, several different experts in different things. One was an expert in ancient art, another one was an archaeologist, one was, I think, on the board of the museum itself. And several of these people, when they saw the statue, they described it as something just felt off about it. It wasn't that they could put their finger on it and say, "This is how I know it's fake." But rather, something just kind of felt funny. And that was the snap judgment that was happening. And that's Malcolm Gladwell's point. But I think that we can take that process, that situation, right, and make some spiritual applications from it. So that's what we're going to do this morning. There's a few interesting things about this story. The first being that the experts who actually spent a lot of time studying the sculpture, right, they were the ones who were deceived by it. Whereas the people who just kind of immediately saw it and then kind of made their gut decision, right, they were the ones who were accurate about it being fake. The people who looked into it extensively, who actually engaged, became deceived because of their own desire for it to be real. When the group was presented with the statue, right, they took the approach that said, "This might be real," or, "It would be so amazing if this was the real deal." They didn't trust their own first gut instinct, that first feeling. They decided to dig deeper. If you look in Genesis chapter 3, let's say we're all pretty familiar with what happens in Genesis 3. It's the first sin. Adam and Eve begin to live in rebellion against God, and they get kicked out of the garden. All of that stuff happens. But there's a moment at the very beginning of Genesis 3. Let's read starting in verse 1. It says, "Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, 'Has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden?' The woman said to the serpent, 'We may eat the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die.'" Really, that's where the conversation should have ended, right? But the serpent says, "You will not surely die. in verse 4. And I don't know if you've ever felt this way, but sometimes, like when I'm in a situation that I know I shouldn't be in, or if my conscience is bothering me or something, my ears start to burn. Right? I don't know if anybody else experiences that. I feel like my ears are turning red. I think that's kind of what Eve felt here. When she had that first inclination. This is a pivotal moment. But instead of making the snap judgment to say, yes, I will, ending this conversation, she decided to look at the fruit, to engage with it. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She decided to investigate. Instead of listening to that first instinctive feeling of, this isn't the best spot, I'm going to get out of this, she decided to investigate. You can look at 2 Samuel. Chapter 11. Again, a fairly familiar account to all of us. 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 1, it says, "It happened in the spring of the year, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold." There's David's moment, right? This is just before his adultery and murder, with adultery with Bathsheba and then murder of her husband. And this was the moment where he could have made the snap judgment, I don't need to be in this situation. I'm going to go back to bed. I shouldn't be here. His ears probably started to burn, if I had to guess. But instead, and I like the word that's used here, in verse 3, it says, "So David sent and inquired about the woman." He engaged. He investigated. Instead of getting out of the situation, making a snap judgment when he felt like he shouldn't be there, he went and inquired. It's that step, the engagement in, I don't feel like I should be here. I have a bad feeling about this, but I have a desire for it. So I'm going to engage. That step makes you start to fall down the hill. We have to be very careful of it. In Proverbs chapter 5, this is teaching directed at young men, especially about the peril of committing adultery. But Proverbs chapter 5 starts off in verse 1. It says, "My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Lend your ear to my understanding, that you may preserve discretion and your lips may keep knowledge. For the lips of an immoral woman drip honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death, her steps lay hold of hell. Lest you ponder her path of life, her ways are unstable, you do not know them." So there's, right, there's the desire pointed out there, that the lips of an immoral woman, they drip honey, right? There's the desire. Her mouth is smoother than oil. But in the end, she's bitter as wormwood. And then the idea that's presented starting in verse 7 is that you ought to just stay really far away from that. And if you feel as though you're close to it, run. Get out. When you feel that bad feeling, that tug toward temptation, step away. In verse 7, it says, "Therefore, hear me now, my children, and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Remove your way far from her, and do not go near the door of her house, lest you give your honor to others and your years to the cruel one, lest aliens be filled with your wealth and your labors go to the house of a foreigner." So they are to stay far away from that situation. In the case of Eve, in the case of David, they decided to step into it, made that choice to investigate when they should have got farther away. The second thing that's interesting about this story about the statue in the museum is that when the statue was unveiled in front of experts who first proclaimed the statue a forgery, They described their immediate impression, and these are quotes from the book. One of the experts called the statue fresh. It was too fresh. You know, when you think about archaeological findings, usually come out of the ground, right? And one of them said, one of them called it too fresh. Another one said they knew something wasn't right. They felt it inside themselves. Something's not right about this. Another one said, this thing doesn't look like it's ever been in the dirt. And that's just their first impression. And those things guided them to the right right conclusion. And so it's important that, I guess there's a prerequisite for this point. You have to be enough of an expert to do this, right? And there's a responsibility on each one of us to be ingrained in the Word to identify things this quickly, right? Okay, so there's your prerequisite. But it's important to trust that feeling of there's something wrong. I'm going to choose to follow God instead. Instead of remaining in that situation, giving yourself the time, the opportunity to investigate the sin, right? There's an importance to step out of it quickly when we realize something's off. Go to Genesis chapter 39. Genesis 39. If you'll remember with me, Joseph, right, was sold into slavery. He ends up in Egypt in the house of Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, important guy. And Potiphar's wife casts longing eyes, is what the text says, on David. She wanted to sleep with him, commit adultery. And David was not about to sin against Potiphar that way or against God that way. And as the story goes, you know, I don't know that David or that Joseph is the perfect example of getting out immediately, right, as soon as the danger presents itself. But in the moment where he might be most tempted, right, she catches a hold of his garment and says, "Lie with me." In that moment, he just runs. And I think that's a good thing to do. He just runs outside. He gets out. I don't know if we take it that far sometimes. We might kind of remind ourselves in our mind, not doing that, you know, or we might take a step back. But David just physically and mentally removes himself from the situation at the presentation of that danger. Joseph. Am I saying David? I keep saying David. Mm-hmm. It's because we were talking about David earlier today. Thanks, Nathan. Joseph removes himself immediately from that situation. And that's the kind of mindset we need to have. Let's go to Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 6. Nehemiah is a great example of many things. And I think that sometimes in our efforts to analyze his leadership, sometimes this one might get a little bit overlooked. But in Nehemiah chapter 6, starting off in verse 1, it says, "Now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies heard that I had rebuilt the wall of Jerusalem, that is, and that there were no breaks left in it, though at that time I had not hung the doors and the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent to me, saying, 'Come, let us meet together among the villages in the plain of Ono.' But they sought to do me harm." So the first thing is he makes that snap judgment. He realizes that that's not a situation he needs to be in, right? And he refuses to go. So there's a gut feeling that's acted on there. Verse 3 says, "So I sent messengers to them, saying, 'I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you?' But they sent me this message 4 times. They keep pestering him about it. And he answers them in the same way. Then Sanballat sent his servant to me as before the 5th time with an open letter in his hand. And it was written, 'It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says that you and the Jews plan to rebel. Therefore, according to these rumors, you are rebuilding the wall that you may be their king.'" And so he accuses Nehemiah essentially of enticing the people of Judah into rebellion against the king, Artaxerxes. Then it says in verse 8, "Then I sent to him, saying, 'No such things as you say are being done, but you invent them in your own heart. for they were all trying to make us afraid, saying, their hands will be weakened in the work, and it will not be done. Now, therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. And afterward, he comes into the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, right? Who was a secret informer. A secret informer. This wasn't the messenger, the servant that Sanballat sent. This was a secret informer, spy. In verse 10, that guy says to Nehemiah, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. Indeed, at night they will come to kill you. Nehemiah says, should such a man as I flee? And who is there, such as I, who would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. There's Nehemiah's snap judgment. This guy says, they're coming to kill you. Let's go into the temple to hide, to save yourself. Nehemiah has that feeling. That's not appropriate. And he decides instead to be courageous and not sin in that way, not go into the temple to save himself. It says in verse 12, then I perceived that God had not sent him at all, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this reason he was hired, that I should be afraid and act that way and sin, so that they might have cause for an evil report, that they might reproach me. Nehemiah's snap judgment saved him in that moment. Then there's Matthew chapter 16. Matthew 16, starting in verse 21. It says, from that time Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. Okay, so Jesus is explaining to his closest group of friends, right, the people that love him, the people that are serving him, obeying him, that he's going to have to die and suffer horrible, awful stuff. And he's telling them about it. And, you know, if you're in that group's shoes, that would be kind of hard to hear. This person that you love, that you obey, that you respect, that you follow, they're saying, I'm going to have to die. I'm going to have to suffer. That would be difficult to hear, right? It was difficult for Peter to hear. In verse 22, Peter takes him aside and begins to rebuke him, saying, far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you. And if you think about what Jesus was probably feeling in that moment, that there's, you know, this man that you love, that you care for, that you're going to die for. And you explain to him, I have to die, I have to suffer. And he says, no, don't do that. You don't have to do that. There's probably a little tug, right, on Jesus' heartstrings in that moment, that he didn't want to just leave Peter. But there's a snap judgment. What does he say to Peter? Get behind me, Satan. You are not an offense to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but of the things of men. Jesus wasn't about to entertain that thought. He just decided to remove himself. He made that snap judgment. He defended against the temptation successfully. The reason the museum, from Malcolm Gladwell's book, was willing to indulge, right, their hopes about the statue is that they had a strong desire for it to be real. And I think that that's important, because often when we succumb to temptation, or when we entertain thoughts that tempt us, it's because we have a desire for that thing, right? And we need to be really careful with that and control that. But it's easy to want to justify the things that we believe we need or believe we want. They thought they were standing to profit from the statue, and so they wanted to justify their purchase of it. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, starting in verse 7. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. Having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. So there's the money, right, temptation there, the love of money being a root of all kinds of evil, but it extends to all desires. If you look at James chapter 1, James chapter 1 and verse 13, says, let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone, but each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then, when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. I think the idea that I'm trying to portray to you this morning is that we cut that process off at the desire. We feel that pull, make a snap judgment and say, I'm going to choose to follow God instead. We remove ourselves from that temptation. We have to follow our gut instinct. I call it the gut defense. The reason that the experts who first proclaimed the statue of forgery were able to identify it as such is because they had such a familiarity with the way things were supposed to be, that they could identify it when something was wrong, when something felt off, right? And we have to develop that skill within ourselves. And, you know, everybody's at different places in their walk with the Lord, different places of knowledge, different places of spiritual maturity. And so it's important that, for one, we're helping each other along, but also that we're practicing and growing and making sure that we are nourishing ourselves appropriately. In Hebrews, chapter 5, and verse 12, this is, you know, they're being, the Hebrew writers rebuking these people for not nourishing themselves appropriately to gain this skill. It says, for though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the first principles of the oracles of God, and you have come to need milk and not solid food. For everyone who partakes only of milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But solid food belongs to those who are of full age. That is, those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. Okay, there's several important words there, right? Unskilled. That takes practice. Developing that takes practice. Reason of use, right? Exercised to discern both good and evil. It takes the time and the dedication to develop that kind of wisdom. You can see it in action in Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4, the first 10 verses, 10 or 11 verses, the devil is tempting Jesus in the wilderness. And Jesus hasn't eaten for 40 days, right? And Jesus' response each time is an immediate going to the word. Verse 4, when he's enduring the first temptation, he quotes, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. He's so ingrained in God's word, in the scriptures, that he can just respond to temptation with them and quell it there instead of investigating. Verse 7, there's his second response. It is written again, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. And then he quotes again the third response, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve. We have to understand the word if we're going to use it that way in our own lives. In Ephesians chapter 4, Ephesians chapter 4, starting in verse 25, says, therefore, putting away lying, let each of you speak truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. Don't even give him an opportunity, not even a little room. Let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give him who has need. Let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good and for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice, and be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you. Those are the things we have to practice if we're going to become experts, to the point where we can sense something's off and react. And each one of us has a responsibility of putting in that kind of work and learning that much, being leaders in that way, being able to say, that looks too fresh. Doesn't look like it's ever been in the ground, right? It's a responsibility each one of us has. If you haven't begun your practicing in that regard, if you haven't taken the initial steps to obey Jesus, obey the gospel in the waters of baptism, repenting, to follow him, making him the king of your life. If you haven't done that, you're just following along those paths of darkness. You're deceived. In order to start working your way out of that, you have to follow after the Lord. So if you haven't done that, this is an opportunity to do so. And also, if you've been falling to temptation, if you've been giving into it, investigating it, this is a time for you to ask for help with that as well. So if you have a need, please let it be made known while we stand and sing.